Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Today, my guest is Jeffrey Drum. Before I bring him on, just a couple of announcements. You can always get new episodes free on Rockfin, Odyssey, and all podcast platforms. Go check us out on Rockfin. This is where you get our premium content. All the shows you can't get anywhere else. You can also get our regular shows. And best of all the amazing content from every creator on Rockfin. Check out all the podcasts we feature on the Forbidden Knowledge Network. You get those on our website, forbiddenknowledge.news. Also, follow us on Facebook. The links are in the description. You can follow us there for announcements and updates. And finally, check out C60 Purple Power, which may be the most powerful antioxidant known to man. The benefits have been personally amazing. Check out their website for yourself by clicking the link in the description. If you order there, you get 10% off plus free shipping. Today I want to welcome Jeffrey Drum. In 2012, he began researching the Egyptian pyramids and some of the alternative theories about their true purpose as a serious side hobby. One of his life's greatest aspirations was to one day see these structures in person. And in 2017, he finally got the chance, with his friend Bethany, agreed to join him on his first week-long trip to Egypt. He had a very specific research-oriented itinerary planned, but his guide included a journey inside the Red Pyramid of Dahchour. Upon entering the pyramid, they became overwhelmed by the intense smell of ammonia and were able to see the chemical staining on the inner chambers. The theories and story contained within his book are inspired by his experience inside the Red Pyramid and his time visiting Egypt, which led him to begin investigating the country's ancient structures with a focus on chemistry. Jeffrey, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing very well, sir. I appreciate you having me on. I'm really excited for today's interview or podcast or whatever.
Yes, I am too. I was looking at your work and it's super fascinating. You have a book, Land of the Chem, an initiation into chemistry through the degrees of the Egyptian pyramids. And you've done a lot of amazing research and you have a bunch of videos on YouTube. If people want to go check out your work, that's also Land of Chem on YouTube.
Correct.
And yes, like I said, you've done some amazing work with this. I can't wait to get into some of the aspects of the hidden history in Egypt, which you've uncovered. But this is your first time on. Tell us a little bit about what got you started down this road of research.
Yeah, absolutely. So I really appreciate you having me on and for the opportunity to come on the show. So I've been interested in the Egyptian pyramids and the Egyptian civilization since I was a kid. I remember, you know, watching Raiders of the Lost Ark with my dad when I was a young one. And that really got me interested in just learning more about Egypt. And I was always fascinated about the civilization and the capabilities of the dynastic Egyptians. And one of my life's greatest aspirations was to one day go to Egypt and see these things in person. And so it was about like 2012, where, you know, the end of the Mayan calendar and the beginning of the age of the dawning of the age of Aquarius. And, you know, we seem to be about the same age range. And it seems like everybody I know around the 2010 to 2012 timeframe started going through this like spiritual reformation.
You too, huh? Yeah, definitely.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, getting into all things esoteric, you know, alternative theories about the Egyptian pyramids, Agartha, giants, all of these sort of miscellaneous theories about alternative ancient history. And I really started researching the Egyptian pyramids as a serious side hobby and, you know, learning about the configuration of the structures, the conventional explanation about the construction of these pyramids, the timeline, et cetera, et cetera. And I was also researching some of the alternative theories about the function of the pyramids, which mostly focus on just the Great Pyramid. So, you know, after 2012, the universe works in mysterious ways. And just out of the blue, I got an opportunity in 2017 to go to Egypt for my first time so I could go see these structures in person. And my agenda was to research some of the theories regarding the Great Pyramid possibly being used to produce electricity. But when I hit the ground in Egypt, I very quickly started to realize that there was a completely different story about these structures. And that's kind of what I have attempted to do within the narrative of the Land of Chem, is paint this picture of the Egyptian pyramids being connected to the production of chemicals on an industrial scale. And that's my hypothesis, is that the pyramids are essentially giant chemical factories.
Yeah, and it's pretty fascinating. I've went through your videos, and it's something that I've never even thought to consider before. But I can't wait to take a look at it. Now, I'm very interested that you mentioned the whole 2012 and a lot of people you know and along with yourself kind of waking up and looking into alternative history and things that have been hidden from us. Do you have any thoughts on what could have been behind? I mean, I know the whole Mayan calendar thing, but anything deeper besides that?
Well, so again, with the Mayan calendar, right, everybody interpreted that as being the end of a certain cycle.
Yeah.
But in my opinion, you know, history and life in general is cyclical. So really what that Mayan calendar was indicating is the end of one cycle and the beginning of another cycle. So as we began to enter, again, it's the dawning of the age of Aquarius that all of these esoteric writers for many, many decades have been talking about, is all of a sudden that we as a civilization are going to go through a golden age, a dawning and a reawakening, kind of a calling to our true purpose type thing. I can't say specifically what caused that, but yeah, like everybody I know started to go through the same thing where it was, you know, shedding off old beliefs and old kind of stale thought patterns and readdressing things from a more enlightened perspective. And yeah, it really kind of set me on this path of discovery that it culminated in me going to Egypt for the first time. Now I've been three times. So
that's really awesome. Now I know you have a lot of information to present in this presentation and we have a short amount of time. So I'm going to kind of cue you up by asking, how advanced do you think this ancient Egyptian civilization was that was building these pyramids, and what kind of technology were they using? Things of that nature.
Yeah. So very, very good question. So the aim of my hypothesis was to come up with a theory that was more compatible with what we know of the actual dynastic Egyptian civilization, right? So there's almost zero evidence that the dynastic Egyptians had electricity. And that's the main focus of all of the theories regarding the Great Pyramid, is that it's an electricity machine, et cetera, et cetera. So in my opinion, the biggest deficiency of that theory is that it focuses on just the one pyramid, right? The Great Pyramid, as if there were no other pyramids in all of Egypt, but there's tons of these structures. And if the Great Pyramid was producing electricity, what is the function of the rest of these things? So again, you know, I can kind of jump in to start in the presentation. This is a good point to do it, because this is kind of right where I kick off. Yeah, let me share my screen here real quick. And I'm going to kill my video just so this doesn't ruin the audio or video quality.
Yeah, I'm going to kill my video as well. So the same thing.
Okay, cool. So yeah, like you mentioned, the title of the book is The Land of Chem. The full title is An Initiation into Ancient Chemistry Through the Degrees of the Egyptian Pyramids. And dude, this is just one of the dopest pictures I have for my 2021 trip to Egypt.
I love that.
It was
that's great.
You know, one of those perfect timing kind of pictures, and really, really like this one. But yeah, so again, your question was, how advanced do I think this civilization was?
Yes.
So we know for sure that even the word chemistry directly correlates to the original name for Egypt. So it's very well proven and researched, even in the conventional archaeological and historical record, that the Egyptians were making chemicals, right? So it's my idea that any civilization that is sufficiently advanced to build structures like the Egyptian pyramids, if they were making chemicals on a small scale, it would certainly make a lot more sense to me that they would want to implement that knowledge of chemistry on an industrial scale for the benefit of the civilization at large. So the title of the book is kind of a play on words. The original name for Egypt is the Land of Chem, K-H-E-M. And the word chem means blackness or darkness. And that refers to the alluvial soil found around the Nile River. However, there was also some connections to alchemy and the negredo, or the blackness, the putrefaction, the fermentation, digestion stages. So there's a lot of connections between our current word for chemistry and alchemy and ancient Egypt. And this next one, so again, the ancient Egyptians were actually the first chemists on the planet. So this isn't necessarily part of my theory. This is just more kind of historical justification for the idea. So we know for sure that the ancient Egyptians were doing many things in fields of applied chemistry. So they were metallurgists. They were making wine and beer, making glass, pigments, dyes, cosmetics, pharmaceuticals. And they were also extracting metal from ore, particularly like copper and gold. And we find in some of these ancient civilizations, extremely pure gold, like 99.999% pure gold. And it's impossible to yield that purity of metal from a smelting process. So to be able to extract those pure metals, you have to use chemical extraction. And again, you know, the word chemistry is literally directly connected to ancient Egypt. So again, that's part of my theory is that, if they were making chemicals on a small scale, they would want to build big old structures and make these things on an industrial scale. And this is actually the first synthetic pigment that was ever produced as a compound called calcium copper silicate. And it's basically a paint or a dye. And even to produce this particular chemical, there was so much of this blue paint utilized in, you know, painting of the tombs and throughout the dynastic Egyptian civilization that you would have to be making just this pigment on an industrial scale. You couldn't make it in just like small batches in a laboratory and have enough of this paint to use it all across the country. So they were definitely making chemicals. And again, I believe that they were making them on a truly industrial scale inside of the pyramids.
That's interesting.
So this one here, this is actually the first artifact that I kind of stumbled across in my 2017 research trip to Egypt. And this is at a site called Abu Sir that you have to get special permission to go out here and see this site. But what you can see here is this red quartzite conduit and a red quartzite collection bowl. And so over here on the right side is actually where the pyramid is located. And the adjacent temple is constructed of limestone, black basalt, and red granite. And there's a black basalt floor that covers the floor of this entire temple. And this red quartzite conduit runs underneath the black basalt floor of this temple and leads directly back to the pyramid. So again, in 2017, I'm kind of a wide-eyed, naive tourist, like just running around the desert. And again, I was looking for connections between these structures and electricity.
Yeah.
But as soon as I saw this, I started scratching my head and the wheels started turning. And I was like, you know, why is there a collection bowl and a conduit for running liquids at a pharaonic burial site? So that was the first thing that I noticed, that, you know, this collection system is not compatible with the pharaonic burial hypothesis, because if this was a burial tomb, A, why would there be flowing liquids? And B, what would they be collecting in terms of those flowing liquids? So that was the first unusual thing. And then it kind of dawned on me, you know, that this could possibly be a manufacturing facility of sorts. And they were collecting the product in the adjacent temples. And that's part of my hypothesis, is that the temples that are adjacent to these pyramids were either for production of the raw materials that were used inside of the pyramids to create the chemical reactions, or they were for collection of the product, which is exactly what we see here at Abu Sir.
Are you going to be covering anything about the actual construction of these pyramids? Because I do have a few questions about that in particular if you do cover that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so I don't talk about the construction specifically within the book, but if you have any questions, I mean, I certainly have my own.
The main question I have is the precise cutting of the stones and how they were able to move the stones such great distances to the quarries.
Absolutely.
And actually construct, you know, so high above, you know, altitude with these massive stones.
Oh, it's really mind-blowing. And I remember in 2017 when we went to the Giza Plateau for the first time. So you go up there and it's literally a 2-minute walk away from the hotel. You can take a right out of the hotel, you walk up a hill and you're right at the Giza Plateau. So I'm walking around and looking up at the pyramids. And of course, the conventional explanation is that they had ramps, you know, like earth ramps that were utilized to drag these stones up to the top.
Yeah.
and you're looking all the way at the top of the Great Pyramid. It's like, how in the hell to build a ramp that size, it would have had to been absolutely just immense to be able to get that high. There's a great researcher. And of course, now that I go to think about it, I can't remember the guy's name, but it's all about physics and fluid dynamics. So these guys were masters of physics and hydraulics. So I believe personally that these stones were floated in place using like airbag flotation, and they were actually floated into place in the building sites. And, you know, there was like a wooden scaffold system built around the pyramid, and they could float these blocks up essentially like conduits that floated them up to the top of the pyramid. So again, I'll have to find that, track down that guy's name and send you the link for it. But yeah, it's all about physics and fluids.
What about the precise cutting of the stones? Any theories about that?
Yeah. So, you know, one thing, so I'm kind of a middle ground guy. You know, I'm not like, you know, an aliens and they're cutting these things with laser beams and this, that, and the other. And I'm also not a, you know, they were using primitive chisels to cut these things and little copper tools. And these things were made by slaves. Mm. So I always make sure to remind people not to underestimate the capabilities of the ancient stonemasons that were cutting these things. So the stone workers back in the ancient times, to be an ancient stonemason was one of the most reputable and honorable professions that you could have in the ancient world. And these guys were the most exceptional professionals that have ever existed on the face of the planet in terms of their capability of cutting and moving stone. So are you familiar with an artifact called the Hierapolis saw?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's like a water-powered sawmill that they discovered in ancient Rome. And of course, we know that the Romans got everything that they know from the dynastic Egyptians. So there's a lot of theorists that's kind of proposed that, you know, this lost ancient high technology, and they were using diamond power tools and this, that, and the other. Again, I'm kind of more of a middle ground person to where they were probably using water powered saws or, you know, other physics and fluid dynamic related machines, wooden machines that were utilized to cut these stones, and, you know, sophisticated cranes and pulley systems and these sort of things, you know, massive, massive wooden apparatus that were utilized to lift and move these stones. So they had, I do believe they had machines, but they were wooden machines, right, similar to what was utilized in the construction of some of the Roman monuments.
That's cool. I'm sorry to deviate from the presentation. I just had a couple of questions
not at
about
all.
That.
Oh, awesome. No, I love this stuff, man. So again, like when you're talking about the Egyptian pyramids, all of these things kind of go hand in hand. You know, it's, you talk about who built them, what time period were they built, how were they built? Mm-hmm. And then again, what was the original purpose of this? So yeah, man, if you have any questions, I have theories on all this stuff, but only some of it's made it into the book so far.
Awesome, man. Well, thank you for that. And go ahead and continue with the presentation by all means.
Oh yeah. So this, again, every time I go, I've been here three times now, and this artifact just blows my mind every time I see it, because it's so clear what the intention of this artifact is. It is for collection of the fluid that was being produced at this site. Again, my immediate first thought was chemicals. So during this first trip, our next stop was the Red Pyramid of Dahshur. And honestly, I didn't even know that we were going to get a chance to go inside of this structure. And you can see in these pictures that there's some very crazy chemical staining inside of these chambers. And there's a lot of discussion about whether or not this is caused by bats, but I have some evidence that proves that this is not caused by bats, that this is actually possibly related to the production of ammonia inside of this pyramid. So again, you can see here on the left, the super dark staining in the upper portion. This is the primary reaction chamber here, your primary steam reformer on the left. And on the right, this is a picture of the final synthesis chamber. And you can see the dark staining starts precisely at the third tier. And there's a very specific reason for why that was occurring. But yeah, this structure, the smell of ammonia coming from this final synthesis chamber is so strong that it'll make your head spin. And I've spent probably a cumulative about 5 or 6 hours inside of this structure trying to wrap my head around it during the past three trips. And after my visit to Abu Sir and after seeing these pyramids, I began to gradually come up with the idea that these were actually chemical reactors inside of the pyramid, and that these structures were essentially the same configuration as any laboratory chemical apparatus, but just implemented on a much larger scale. So my first job in assessing these structures is breaking down the individual components into units of a chemical manufacturing process. So you're going to have an inlet shaft, an outlet shaft, you're going to have connecting tubes, you're going to have reactors, you're going to have heaters, all of these components. You can find all of these within the Egyptian pyramid. So that was kind of the genesis of the theory as I began to explore Egypt for the first time.
Wow. So you can find all of the components, say for this, you know, basic chemistry set inside of the pyramid that all links to a production of some sort of chemicals?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, you know, here down on the bottom right, let's just take a look at this like distillation tube here, for example. So when I was assessing the Great Pyramid, part of my original theory was that the Grand Gallery functioned as possibly a distillation tube, and for distillation and separation of certain compounds. I eventually kind of scrapped that theory and ended up going with a different concept. But yeah, so again, if you look in here, there's always something going in, there's something going out, and then there's the reaction vessel. Well, that's exactly what you find inside of these pyramids. So for example, within the Red Pyramid here on the bottom left, this is actually a pump shaft that's utilized to manipulate water level inside of these reaction chambers. And I do believe that there is an outlet shaft that leads out of this final synthesis chamber. And there is some evidence that that actually exists. So it's not just a theory that I've come up with.
Now, how much, you know, knowledge of chemistry did you have before going into this and putting these, you know, connecting these dots?
So I was always fascinated by chemistry. So I don't have any academic background in chemistry. Mm-hmm. You know, again, I was just a kind of a wide-eyed tourist that ended up going in 2017 to see these structures. But I have literally spent, and it's funny to look back on it now, literally every minute of the past 4 years of my life has been dedicated to learning all of the chemistry, the industrial chemistry, the chemical mm-hmm. engineering, all aspects of chemistry as related to the Egyptian pyramids. So I've spent probably 10 years researching the pyramids themselves in terms of the configuration and the construction. And the past 4 years, I've been learning about the chemistry kind of from scratch. But that being said, before I ever put this theory out to the public, I did work with a gentleman that has a PhD in chemical engineering and has several international and US patents in the field of chemical engineering. So I wanted to run this whole theory by somebody that had professional and academic qualifications to give me some genuine critique on the theory. And this guy, his name is Ed, he believed in this theory so much that at the end of the day, so he tore this thing to pieces, right? So my dad somehow ended up going to see this presentation on the seven principles of Hermetic philosophy. Are you familiar with the Kybalion?
Yeah.
So yeah, my dad, retired military colonel, ends up going to see this presentation on esoteric information, which I never thought in my entire life that he would go to see something like that. But anyway, he starts talking to the guy giving the presentation. Turns out Ed, that guy, had a PhD in chemical engineering. So my dad gets his contact information. I talked to Ed, and I showed him presentations that are very similar to what I have on my YouTube channel and very similar to the presentation that I'm showing you today. And he told me that he was going to treat me like one of his graduate students presenting my dissertation. And he scientifically dismantled this theory, like tore it to shreds, and had me rebuild every single detail from the most minute aspects of the function of this part, or, you know, how much pressure can we get in here? And what is the chemical reaction occurring in this part? And I presented all of this material to him, and we worked together for probably a year before I ever put this material out and published my book. So yeah, I don't personally have a lot of experience in terms of academic or professional chemistry, but I have certainly, you know, been through the ringer in terms of making sure that my theories are solid and, you know, compatible right. with chemical engineering knowledge.
Very good. Cool.
So when I got back from Egypt, again, I'm kind of coming up with this crazy idea that the pyramids are designed to produce chemicals. So I'm like, all right, well, let's research this and see what I can come up with. And I've always been a huge student of alchemy and, again, kind of chemistry in general, just kind of as a passion. It's something I've always been interested in. Mm-hmm. And you'll see here, these are the three stages of the alchemical process: the negredo, the albedo, and the rubedo. And you'll see the black, the white, and the red. Well, as soon as I started to look at this, I immediately realized there are some direct connections to what we find in Egypt. So black, white, and red are utilized all throughout Egyptian iconography, but it's also utilized in the construction of these pyramids. So there's tons of black basalt, and I talked about that at Abu Sir. There's all of this white limestone and plenty of red granite. So again, we see the black, the white, and the red represented in the construction of these structures, which again, I think that some of this ancient knowledge has been passed down through generations to generations. And at some point, these Egyptian pyramids became inoperational, and this knowledge began to be hidden within these esoteric societies of alchemists that, instead of practicing it on a large scale, they were kind of hiding and protecting this knowledge, throughout the medieval times, where practicing science and chemistry will very quickly get you burned at the stake. So again, they kind of hid this knowledge under the veil of alchemy. I've dug through tons and tons of alchemical diagrams and things like that. And in the final chapter of the book, I talk about the passage chamber structures of Ireland, like Newgrange. And you see here on the right, these mounds, these passage mounds, and the alchemy or the chemical reactions are occurring inside of these mounds. And you see the same thing here on the right. I kept seeing these recurring images of alchemy or chemistry occurring inside of a massive structure. And you can see here, this is very representative of like a step pyramid on the right. So again, I just started to find these connections between the pyramids and chemistry that gave me the idea that I was on the right track. And as I began kind of pulling at the thread of this little hypothesis, everything began to unravel and the picture became very clear, is that, you know, these structures are definitely connected to ancient chemistry. So this image is just a picture of the area around Saqqara. And the first chapter of the book discusses the step pyramid of Saqqara. And part of my hypothesis is this structure was designed to produce methane gas. And there are some very, very interesting connections between methane, the step pyramid, and some esoteric symbols that we see within the dynastic Egyptian religion. Okay, good. I did my slide presentation well, and I have all these things in order. So yeah, this is the configuration of the step pyramid of Saqqara here on the left. Mm-hmm. And on the right, you will see the configuration of a modern biogas digester. And these today are utilizing cattle manure in a slurry. So they mix the cattle manure with water and agricultural scrap material. And through the inlet shaft, it is placed into the primary digestion chamber. The methane gas comes out of the top, and then you have a displacement shaft out to the side. Well, that's exactly what we see in the original configuration of the step pyramid. So this is one of the most complicated structures to analyze, because there have been so many stages of reconstruction of this pyramid. So you see here on the left, the original format of the step pyramid is actually a single level platform. And originally, the only components of this structure were the inlet shaft, the primary digestion chamber, and the outlet shaft. So again, it has the exact same configuration and capabilities of a modern biogas digester, and the methane gas would have just percolated up through the solution and been collected out here at the top of the mastaba. And of course, you know, these two images from, you know, the dynastic Egyptian religion, there are two very prevalent symbols, the sacred cow or the sacred bull and the scarab. And of course, my theory is that, well, so let me say this, with the cattle, the deification of cattle in the ancient world never really made much sense to me. I understood that it was an important agricultural animal. Mm-hmm. You know, its symbolism is used to represent strength and fertility and all of these sorts of things. And of course, there's astrological connections in terms of the constellation Taurus, et cetera, et cetera. But I never really truly understood why cattle were essentially gods to these ancient civilizations. Well, as I started to research the connection between the pyramids and chemistry, I began to realize that if they were utilizing cattle manure to produce what was essentially a mysterious or spiritual compound, it would make a lot more sense that they would deify the animals from which this essential chemical was being created. So again, I believe that the deification of cattle is directly connected to methane gas, and the same thing with the symbol of the scarab. So with any great esoteric symbols, there's always multiple layers of interpretation, right? So you have your layer of interpretation that's intended for the general public, which is mostly related to religion or spirituality. And then there's these deeper interpretations that are intended for the initiates of the sacred mysteries. So the scarab, for example, is a dung rolling beetle. And according to the dynastic Egyptian religion, the dung rolling beetle is supposed to represent the rising sun. It also has connotations to resurrection, rebirth, and immortality. Well, again, that was another symbol that never really made any sense to me, because this is it's a shit rolling beetle, you know? Yeah. So how is that supposed to be a symbol of the golden sun? Cause it's really pushing a ball of turds around the floor. Well, if you were utilizing cattle manure to produce methane gas, well, the first step in the process is collection of the cattle manure. And that's exactly what we see in the habits of the ancient scarab. It collects dung, it makes it into a ball, and it delivers it. Well, that's exactly the first step in the process in producing methane gas.
Wow, that's a very interesting connection.
Yeah, and like you mentioned before, so I scoured the internet when I was developing this hypothesis to see if anybody else had ever talked about anything like this. And it's a very unique theory or hypothesis, whatever you want to call it. And I've never found anybody that addresses these alternate interpretations of these symbols. And again, to me, it's a more practical interpretation, and it's something that makes a lot more sense when you connect it to what we know about. So again, I don't necessarily believe that the pyramids themselves were built by the dynastic Egyptians, but all of the knowledge that this civilization had was carried on and passed into the religion and the knowledge of the dynastic Egyptians. So they utilized these symbols. And I do believe that there were people within the dynastic Egyptian religion that still understood the true meaning of these ancient symbols.
Right. Yeah. And you're absolutely right. You know, they have the spiritual or religious aspects of these symbols, and then the astrological, which, you know, I've been looking at it a lot lately, and that's where kind of a lot of researchers stop, is, you know, the astrological aspects, because, you know, they believe that the ancients had a great knowledge of the stars beyond what they thought was capable, and that a lot of the symbology, even throughout the Bible and ancient text, has to do with just strictly astrological knowledge and basically telling a story of astrology.
Yeah. So these ancient civilizations were very adept at encoding the knowledge into these wonderful stories. And I literally believe that the Egyptian pyramids were intended as encyclopedias of ancient knowledge. And the individuals that built these structures intended them to encode and hold all of this knowledge that was possessed by the civilization, so that if anything ever happened, it could be rediscovered later on in the future. So there's, you know, geometry and mathematics, there's physics, there's chemistry, there's construction, there's all of these different aspects. Again, astrology, knowledge of the universe, all of these things are literally built into stone. They're encyclopedias in stone of all of this ancient knowledge. And even with the cattle, I mean, that's a great symbol, even in like the Indian culture and, Chinese and Japanese and sort of Asian cultures as well, also have a lot of symbols related to the ancient cattle. Well, the ancient Indians were also practicing chemists. And there's another artifact called the Iron Pillar of Delhi, which even modern chemists still do not understand the chemical composition of that metal pillar. And it's supposedly made of iron, but the thing has never rusted. So they still don't understand the chemistry that was being done by the ancient Indians. And again, biogas digesting and production of methane from cattle manure is something that is still incredibly prevalent in India. So they're still utilizing this technology today. And I believe, again, it's traces from a very ancient civilization that are, you know, still in use and still practical today. This slide just shows kind of the configuration of the Red Pyramid of Dahshur, which personally is one of my favorite structures to discuss. And so the whole operation of this structure is related to very simple physics. So the ideal gas laws state that if you reduce the volume of a gas, you are going to increase its temperature and pressure. So let's say you have a gas in a normal size container and you squeeze that container down. Those molecules are going to be moving a lot faster. They're going to be banging into each other a lot more, which is essentially what exactly happens when you increase temperature and pressure, right? So that's a way to facilitate chemical reactions. So I started to analyze the components and realize that there is significantly reduced volume towards the upper part of the chamber. So let's say you filled this whole chamber with gas. And in this particular instance, so the manufacturing cycle begins at the step pyramid and they're producing methane gas. The methane gas was then transported to the Red Pyramid and they were converting that methane gas into an ammonia solution. So methane is a water insoluble gas. So if you fill this first chamber with methane gas, for example, and then begin to fill this chamber with water, it's going to press that methane gas into the upper portion of the vault. Again, reducing the volume, increasing the temperature and pressure. And there's a couple of small details that I'm leaving out in regard to the function of this structure, just for, you know, surprise sake and anybody that wants to read the book. And I actually have a second book coming up not too long. But there are some other aspects involved that would have further increased the temperature and pressure inside the structure, but that's the basic physics. And long story short, it culminated in the production. So essentially you're transforming methane and you're getting hydrogen gas in chamber one. In chamber two, you're going to introduce air and get nitrogen. And then in chamber three, you're going to combine your hydrogen and nitrogen to produce ammonia gas. And then this chamber would have been filled with water. Ammonia gas is highly soluble in water. So the ammonia gas dissolves into solution, creating your ammonia solution in the final synthesis chamber. So it's very, very simple physics. Again, kind of the same concept with the construction of the pyramids is that these guys were masters of science. And they utilized that science to not only build the structures, but also to produce chemicals inside the structures. And again, this is it's a very novel theory. And again, I've never heard anybody else talk about the Egyptian pyramids as having these sort of capabilities. Again, everybody wants to just say, oh, the Great Pyramid makes electricity and the Great Pyramid makes electricity. Well, that's fine. And I don't necessarily. So one of the great things about the Egyptian pyramids is that most of the theories about these structures are not mutually exclusive. So have you ever heard of Larry Paul with the American Institute of Pyramid Research?
No, I have not.
So Larry's a great guy and he's another researcher, but he focuses specifically on the mathematics and geometry, right? So that's one aspect of the construction. There's other theorists that say that the pyramid body itself could have been utilized for making electricity. Well, that's cool too, but that doesn't necessarily exclude my theory of the interior components being utilized to produce chemicals. So again, just because I think the inside are producing chemicals doesn't mean that these structures could possibly have other capabilities. Again, I really do believe that these are multifunctional structures and, you know, the true purpose and the true capabilities of these things are completely beyond our comprehension. You know, this is just my best attempt to come up with a theory that incorporates all of the structures. So within the book, I talk about the step pyramid, the red pyramid, the bent pyramid, the Giza pyramids and also the passage chamber structures of Ireland. So it's a much more comprehensive overview of the potential function of all of these ancient pyramids.
Do you think there was any connection with the obelisks or any other ancient monolithic or megalithic structures that may have been near the pyramids?
Oh, 100%. And I'm glad you brought that up. So on my Instagram channel or my Instagram page, whatever those things are called these days, I posted a little bit of a teaser of an experiment that we did. So the obelisks absolutely had a function, as did the stone body of the pyramid itself was also functional. And I'm going to be getting to that in my second book. And that was one of the reasons that I went back to Egypt in 2020 and 2021 was to do research for the second book. So long story short, our guide Yusuf, and shout out to Yusuf for being the absolute best tour guide in Egypt. And he's the same guy that tours with like Graham Hancock and Randall Carlson and Brian Forrester and Ben from Ancient Architects and all of these other channels. Everybody works with Yusuf. And again, I can't say enough good things about him. So he has a machine that produces an electromagnetic energy field. And I have a little preview on my Instagram channel of this experiment. We actually did like a 30-minute long experiment where we're testing the properties of the stones that were utilized in the construction in proximity to the electromagnetic energy field being produced by this machine. And, you know, check out my Instagram, and I'll also be posting a video eventually on my YouTube channel about it. But there were some very, very interesting results of what happens when you put limestone on top of the machine, and then you could put granite on top of the machine, and it has a different effect. The black basalt has a different effect. And we were also testing a mock Djed pillar. So a Djed pillar is another artifact in ancient Egypt, very similar to an obelisk, but kind of a different configuration. And it's a limestone pillar that has alternating rings of red granite and black basalt. So again, we built a Djed pillar out of stone and sat it on top of the machine and again, tested the properties of the stone. Very, very interesting results. And again, I don't want to really spoil the surprise for anybody that wants to check it out, but there's a lot more going on with these structures than even I've put out so far. And I'll get to it eventually whenever I write this second book.
Oh, that's cool. And you mentioned Graham Hancock. For anyone that's interested, this weekend, Graham is putting on a conference at Gaia in Colorado Springs. I'll be there covering it. Awesome. It'll be
I was actually just in Colorado Springs a week ago.
Yeah, I love
Colorado Springs, man.
Definitely. So if anybody wants to come out, hang out with me and check out Graham's conference, that's this weekend at Gaia. So
And so speaking of Graham Hancock, I'm a huge fan of his work and his research. And so part of the Land of Kem is a fictional story, right? It's just my attempt to paint the bigger picture of what the true function of these structures were and when they were built. So Graham Hancock focuses a lot on, you know, the end of the last ice age, circa 10,000 BC, and the destruction of the North American continent during the cataclysm that ended the last ice age. Well, I believe that the survivors of that cataclysm, so my theory is that North America is Atlantis. And there was originally a massive, sophisticated civilization in North America that was completely wiped out at the end of the last ice age with the cataclysm, you know, the comet that struck the North American ice cap, causing floods and all this sort of destruction across North America. Well, there would have been survivors from that cataclysm that fled across the ocean and settled in Europe, Africa, South America, and even in Asia. And that's what we see in the mythology from all of these ancient civilizations, like the arrival of Quetzalcoatl in South America, or the arrival of the Tuatha De Danann, the ancient mythological gods of Ireland, or even, you know, like Nuwa and Fuzi in Japan and China. They have these myths of these gods arriving with science and knowledge and all of this information intact. Well, those were the survivors of that ancient cataclysm. They fled across the ocean, reestablished the civilizations in all of these new areas, and they implemented their knowledge of physics and chemistry in these massive structures to enable them to reestablish their civilization. So again, their homeland was completely wiped out. They fled to all of these new areas and started building pyramids and these other structures that allowed their civilization to thrive again. And this is, again, from the time frame from 10,000 BC to about 4,000 BC. And there were other cataclysms around that time period that led to these structures falling out of operation. And that's when we see the beginning of the dynastic Egyptians, the Sumerians around 3000 BC, with all of that knowledge already intact, having been inherited from this ancient civilization. It's really fascinating. And there's definitely some connections between ancient Ireland and ancient Egypt. Some of the mythology from ancient Ireland is absolutely my favorite. And one of the other kind of hypotheses in the book is that, so there's all these stories of ancient magic across the planet. So let's take it from the perspective of it's not magic, it's chemistry. So if somebody is looking at a practitioner of chemistry and he's doing an experiment and he's got a jar of clear water and a jar of clear water, and he pours those two things together and all of a sudden it turns blue, right? Or you pour one liquid into another liquid and all of a sudden there's solid compounds, a precipitation reaction. Or if you're lighting metal sparks on fire and there's blue flame or there's yellow flame or there's green flame, right? These are all imagery that we see associated with ancient magic. Well, if you look at it from the perspective of chemistry, someone that hadn't been initiated into the ancient science of chemistry, it would have been indistinguishable from magic. And there's lots of mythology, particularly with the ancient Irish. So the Tuatha De Danann are the ancient mythological gods of Ireland. And they arrived to Ireland with all of these magic weapons and all of this magic. That's right. So there's an example called the Spear of Lu, which is a magical spear that had to be submerged in water to keep it from spontaneously igniting. Well, as soon as I heard that story, I immediately thought of phosphorus, because phosphorus is a chemical that if you put it in air, it is going to spontaneously ignite. And it is an incredibly useful chemical weapon that, again, I believe was utilized by this ancient civilization. But we hear it presented as magic because it's from the perspective of the onlookers, right? The enemies that are getting attacked by these magical weapons, and they don't understand that it's actually chemistry.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And that's actually one of my favorite videos on my YouTube channel is my episode on ancient magic and chemistry. And I think that's one of the videos that has the least amount of views on my channel. But it's one of my favorites, and it's the best work that I've done, but nobody's interested in that video.
Oh man, after this everybody's gonna go watch it.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah, man, we'll get everybody there.
But it's pretty remarkable the way that YouTube and social media works. So I've been grinding away for like the past year, putting videos out on YouTube, and all of these things had like 100 views on it. Well, all of a sudden, when I get back from Egypt a couple of weeks ago, I guess somebody had shouted out my channel on a comment section, and all of a sudden, in a 2-week time frame, I went from having 100 views on all my videos to one of my biggest one is 15,000 views right now.
Oh, wow, man. That's congratulations. That's
well, I appreciate
great.
It, it's still a drop in the bucket, compared to other YouTube channels out there. But for me, it was so overwhelming and amazing to see the theory finally catching on, and people have really enjoyed the material so far. So, I appreciate everybody that's subscribed to the YouTube channel, has been checking out the videos. It's a really cool feeling. Now, if I could only get myself up to 15,000 subscribers, that would be great. Oh, I think I have like 1,100 right now. So thank you to all 1,100 subscribers of the Land of Chem YouTube channel. I appreciate the support.
Oh, hell yeah, man. We'll get you some more, too. You'll get there, definitely. And yeah, people are hungry for this stuff right now, like we were talking about earlier. They want to know their real truth because they've been lied to about our whole history. So, this stuff is what people want to hear.
Well, I'm going to be putting out a video coming up soon on my YouTube channel called The Fallacies of the Pharaonic Burial Hypothesis. And one of the first things that I'm going to be talking about, so look here on the right, the configuration of the Red Pyramid. So there is plenty of depictions of pharaonic burials, and it was a huge ceremonial procession, right? A huge funeral procession, and they're carrying this sarcophagus, and the sarcophagus is in a huge box, and this, that, and the other. And they take it to the burial site, and all the burial sites have steps. Steps leading down into your burial chamber. The shaft leading to the burial chamber is huge. Plenty of room for somebody to stand up and carry this big sarcophagus and box into the burial chamber. And the burial chamber is a rectangle. It's a very, very simple configuration. Well, my first question is, so look at where the shaft is leading into the reaction chambers of the Red Pyramid. To even get the body up there, you would have to build a wooden scaffold outside of this structure. You would have to drag the body up the wooden scaffold. And then what are you going to do? Are you going to slide the sarcophagus down this shaft into the burial chambers? That doesn't really make any sense whatsoever to me. These shafts are all of like 3 feet by 3 feet, you know, square. No room for anybody to stand up, no steps whatsoever. And again, it would be a very unceremonial burial for your godlike pharaoh to be sliding his body down a shaft into one of these burial chambers. And again, even in like the Great Pyramid, for example, the sarcophagus, quote unquote sarcophagus inside the Great Pyramid, you could hypothetically lie down inside of that container, but there is absolutely no other room, right? So like my body would fit in there, but there's no room for a golden sarcophagus or anything else. And we know that the dynastic Egyptians buried their dead in essentially, you know what a rushing nesting doll is?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's layer upon layer, right, and it gets bigger and bigger the more it goes to the outside. And that's what we know. We know for sure that's how they buried them. Well, you're not fitting a golden sarcophagus inside of that container. Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Nor is there any indication within any of these chambers. So there's no hieroglyphs. There's no statues. There's no paintings. There's no indication whatsoever inside of these chambers that they are burial chambers.
Right.
And even when you go inside, so like on the Giza Plateau, for example, the Great Pyramid has three smaller pyramids flanking it. And you can go inside the burial chambers of those smaller pyramids. And, you know, there's burial stuff in there. There's hieroglyphs, there's statues, there's paintings, there's small rectangular chambers that have steps leading down into it. So those smaller pyramids were absolutely built by the dynastic Egyptians for burials. And it's very clear as soon as you walk into them, you're like, hey, I'm inside of a burial chamber.
Right.
But when you go inside these things,
yeah,
I remember the first time I went down inside the Red Pyramid, and it takes 10 minutes to even get down inside the structure.
Yeah.
So it's a real pain in the ass to even get down inside here. And then you walk into this thing, and there's, again, there's some original pictures that were taken before. So when you go in this thing now, there's wooden plank flooring that covers up all this stone. Hmm. And here on the right, this is in the second chamber leading up to the final synthesis chamber. And there's a huge wooden staircase that completely covers up this section. And they've done their best to clean this and remove all of the staining from inside of these chambers. But you can see there's multiple different types of staining patterns inside of this structure. So here on the lower portion, you can see kind of this flowing movement on the lower part of the stone.
Yeah.
There's drip staining in the lower portion of the chamber. And then there's this super dark staining in the upper vaults and also here on the southern wall of the secondary air reformer. So very unusual stuff and highly incompatible with the pharaonic burial theory.
Yeah.
I love these old pictures of the Red Pyramid.
Yeah, that's awesome. They're like, I like that.
Smoking, it's literally smoking gun evidence that there was some sort of chemical reaction going on inside of these chambers. Yeah, so this is a great slide too. Again, this is one of the things that I uncovered when I began to research the production of ammonia. So the word ammonia literally comes from ancient Egypt. So the name ammonia was originally called sal ammoniac, which is a word that means salt of Amon. Well, anyone that's familiar with dynastic Egyptian religion will immediately recognize the Egyptian deity Amon. So again, the name ammonia comes directly from the god Amon. And the word ammon means invisible or hidden. So ammonia gas is something that is invisible or hidden until you go through the extraction process of retrieving the chemical. So again, there's some very interesting esoteric or multiple layers of interpretation of these ancient deity names. And they were producing ammonia on a small scale. So ammonia used to be produced by extracting it from camel dung. But again, my theory is that any civilization that knows how to produce chemicals on a small scale, if they also have the capability of building these massive pyramids, they're also going to be making chemicals on a large scale, which is exactly what we in our modern day civilization did during the modern industrial revolution. Is we had the capability of producing chemicals on a small scale. And as soon as we had the capability of building, you know, large scale reactors, we started making even ammonia on a large scale, and it completely changed the nature of our modern day civilization.
Yeah, that would totally make sense. Especially, you know, with all the other advancements that the dynastic Egyptians possibly had, and the theories of how advanced their culture was, why wouldn't they be building large structures to mass produce chemicals? Because they were highly advanced in, you know, astrology, science, mathematics, all these other things. Why not chemistry, right?
And so that was one of my original things that really perplexed me about the Egyptian pyramids. So I understand that, you know, for pharaonic burial and the pharaoh is a god and you want to build this massive structure to, you know, make sure that your god goes down in history and this, that, and the other. Well, it just made a lot more sense to me if they were going to invest all of the time and effort and resources into building these things, that they would actually have some sort of practical purpose. Because even in the burials of the dynastic Egyptian pharaohs, again, it's all done at the Valley of the Kings. And these structures, these burials are very much hidden underground, right? Unless you were excavating and looking for it, you wouldn't necessarily even know that there was a burial there, which is kind of the intention of a burial, right? Is to make sure that people never get in there.
Yeah.
Well, so if this was a burial, why would you make it the biggest monument? Like, here it is, everybody. Make sure to look right inside here. You're looking for the gold and the burials. Well, here it is. Again, that never really made sense to me. And again, it's more of a practical idea that these giant, massive infrastructure projects, which is essentially what it was, were designed for the benefit of the civilization at large. Because again, chemicals are going to benefit everyone. It's not just for, you know, some pharaoh's burial. This is something that was applicable for the entire civilization.
Right. Yeah, the whole pharaoh's burial never made sense to me, but go ahead.
And I was blown away when I found this particular piece of information, because I had a feeling that ammonia was, but I didn't know that the word literally comes from the same name as the deity Ammon.
Yeah, that is
so ammonia literally has its origins in ancient Egypt.
Man, that is really important piece of evidence. That's cool.
So here we go. And this is kind of one of my favorite parts of the development of this theory. Mm-hmm. So again, I'm researching the connection between the Egyptian pyramids and chemistry and alchemy. And I start looking into the modern industrial revolution and how we produce these chemicals today on an industrial scale. And this was one of the first pictures that I kind of stumbled across. And this was one of the first apparatus that was developed to produce ammonia. And we eventually turned this small apparatus into a giant manufacturing process where they make this on an industrial scale. But let's look at the configuration of this thing here. So you have an inlet shaft going into your primary steam reformer. There's a connecting shaft that leads from your first reformer into your second reformer. And then your third and final synthesis chamber is elevated above the two. So the guy that built this, he stuck these two here at the same level. And then this one's up here in the air. You see how that's configured?
Yeah.
Okay. So now take a look at the configuration of the red pyramid. So again, you have inlet shaft going into your primary steam reformer. connecting shaft into your secondary aeroformer, and then your final synthesis chamber is elevated above the other two. Well, here on the right is the configuration of the red pyramid. You have your inlet shaft, you have your primary steam reformer, a connecting shaft that leads into your secondary aeroformer, and then those chemicals are then pushed into your final synthesis chamber where they are used to produce the ammonia solution. And this apparatus on the left uses the exact same physics that I believe were involved here in the Red Pyramid, but also implement electricity, much higher temperatures and pressure. And today we use catalysts to make these synthesis happen faster and more effectively. Now, I am not implying that the chemical manufacturing process inside of the Red Pyramid was anywhere as efficient as our modern day manufacturing process. But after talking with Ed, the gentleman that has the PhD in chemical engineering, this idea is still plausible, and the chemical reactions are still feasible in this high temperature, high pressure environment that was created inside the pyramid.
Wow, that is really fascinating. And I used to be of the consideration that maybe our advanced civilizations, possibly got knowledge from off-planet entities, maybe aliens, maybe something spiritual. And sure, it wasn't until recently that I started considering, what if we were just advanced? We've always been advanced humans. They're starting to find evidence of humans that could be, Homo sapiens sapiens, that could be up to millions of years old with advanced tools that they're finding with them. So why couldn't we have just been advanced from the beginning? Is that so much of a hard concept? But it's something that I love to consider. And this is a great new aspect to look at ancient Egypt and what they could have been doing with these massive megalithic structures.
And there's a big fat juicy conspiracy theory right in the middle of all of this thing that's related to the guy that made this apparatus and the production of ammonia and our modern industrial revolution. I haven't talked about that publicly, and maybe we could get to that one day, but man, there's a juicy conspiracy theory right smack dab in the middle of this thing. And I happen to agree with you. Everything in life in the universe is cyclical, and there have been rises and falls in our level of intellectual capability and the sophistication of our civilizations. Mm-hmm. Well, the civilization that came before the dynastic Egyptians had all of this knowledge.
Yeah.
Cataclysms happened, and then we fall into a lower stage, and then you see it kind of rising up again through the Greek and Roman period. The Roman civilization collapsed, and then you see the downfall into the medieval time period. Well, the medieval time period, and then it gradually rises up again during the Renaissance time period. And then we get into the modern industrial revolution. So again, it's been kind of a rise and fall of the knowledge and capability of our general human civilization throughout time. And I always hear that this old phrase, like, nothing under the sun is new. Everything is old, and everything has just been rediscovered. That's a piece of that little bit of conspiracy theory there. But yeah, you're absolutely right. And I happen to agree with you in terms of, I believe that the human beings back in this time period, again, let's talk about the end of the last ice age. They were human beings, but they were different than what we are today. And they possibly had capabilities that we have lost touch with. For example, different ways to perceive electromagnetic energy and all of these things. Our brains are incredibly capable processing machines. And I truly believe that, with all of the chemicals in our food and the radiation and the electromagnetic frequencies and all of these other things that have been pumped into our bodies since birth, those things are designed to make us lesser human beings than what we could possibly be or what we were originally.
Oh, yeah.
So the humans that built these structures, again, they were human beings, but they're not what we are today. That's kind of one of the more out there ideas that I have. But again, these were built by humans, but humans then were much different. They were much more intelligent. They were much more in tune with natural forces and in harmony with the universe and in nature. And they utilized all this knowledge, again, for the benefit of the civilization at large.
Yeah. And that probably, is closer to the truth than most would imagine. And, the more we learn, the more we kind of have to look towards that direction,
I love how there's like, you know, there's certain animals out there that can see electromagnetic energy fields or even like synesthesia, you know, like they call it a condition where people can see sounds and hear all that. So those sorts of abilities, I believe that we as human beings originally had all of those capabilities. And again, gradually
but some
over
people
time,
would think, you know, psi phenomenon or psychic abilities is probably like a natural ability that we had.
Oh, 100%. You know, the telepathy and all of these other sorts of ideas. Again, I think that the human civilization is far more capable than we are led to believe we are. But so this side, again, I just kind of wanted to give a preview of some of the other structures that I talk about in the book.
Sure.
So this is the bent pyramid of Dahshur, and the bent pyramid is directly behind the red pyramid. And even today in our modern industrial manufacturing process, so you have your ammonia plant and you're harnessing the byproducts of ammonia production, which is mainly carbon dioxide. And that carbon dioxide is utilized in a secondary facility for the production of urea. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't believe that the bent pyramid was used to make urea. I believe that it was used to make a chemical called ammonium bicarbonate, which is essentially a combination of ammonia solution and carbon dioxide gas, which creates a solid compound. So the ammonia was utilized for fertilizer. And again, that's a very practical, reasonable chemical that's very compatible with what we know of the dynastic Egyptian civilization, is that this was a massive agricultural civilization. And people tend to forget, because again, the history books would lead you to believe that, you know, the slaves are building the pyramids, or the farmers, they would work on the farms during the summer, and during the flood, they would go work on the pyramids and build the pyramids in their part-time. Mm-hmm. That is absolute nonsense. And this was a massive, massive civilization. They would have had huge populations that, again, you need fertilizer to be able to produce the quantity of food to support a civilization like this. And again, if you're making not a liquid ammonia, because that's another thing altogether, but an ammonia solution, which is essentially ammonia gas dissolved in liquid, it's very difficult to transport and store that stuff. So you would want to turn it into a solid compound that could be very easily transported to the fields, transported to the farmlands, applied to the crops, et cetera, et cetera. And then you can utilize the ammonia solution for other purposes. So all of the products that were being created inside of these structures, a portion was utilized for consumption by the population. For example, methane gas, you know, according to the archaeological record, even the ancient Chinese and the ancient Iranians were tapping into natural gas seeps and using methane for cooking, heating, lighting, metallurgy specifically. So again, if you're using a very high temperature methane flame to do your metallurgy, it's a lot better than just, you know, burning a bunch of sticks and trying to, you know, stoke a fire and create metal using that sort of fire. They were using methane gas for metallurgical purposes. I also talk about, you know, the Great Pyramid of Giza and the Central Pyramid of Giza. And this is another great structure again. So this shaft leading down to the subterranean chamber, this was the only original shaft that leads into the pyramid. So again, if this is for a burial, you're going to slide your pharaonic burial body down here into the subterranean chamber. Well, that doesn't do you very good, because then what are you going to tie the pharaoh's legs to a string and then drag the body up through this well shaft and then carry it here into the king's chamber? Again, a very unceremonial burial for the godlike pharaoh.
Yeah.
So again, there's a lot of things about these structures in terms of the pharaonic burial hypothesis that's not very compatible. This is a functional machine. And same thing with the central pyramid. Again, this is one of those. So the Great Pyramid is right here next to it. And again, all the theorists that focus on the Great Pyramid producing electricity kind of just neglect that there's another massive structure sitting right here. And all of the hieroglyphs that speak about the Great Pyramid actually depict the Central Pyramid. And in the ancient times, this was the structure that was known as the Great Pyramid. So this is of the utmost importance in the function of the Giza Plateau. So the Giza Plateau also works as a system. So in this first book, I'm just talking about the function of the inside of these structures, but there was something else going on that incorporated the outside and the rest of these structures in general. And then in the final chapter of the book, the protagonist, Aquari, returns home to Ireland, and he applies the knowledge that he's gained in the degrees of the Egyptian pyramids to reinterpreting the original purpose for structures like Newgrange, which I believe was also designed to produce chemicals. And this is the curbstone of Newgrange, which is a large, and to this date, no one has provided an interpretation for the meaning of the symbols. Well, I believe that these symbols are actually a chemical reaction equation, and they are depicting the chemical reaction sequence that was occurring inside of this structure. So literally sitting right out in front of the structure is instructions for how this thing originally operated. It's the, my favorite chapter of the book is the last chapter, just because I'm of Irish descent. And it was one of the things that I always wanted to go see was to go see Ireland. So in 2017, I went to Egypt, and then I'm writing the book and developing this theory. And I knew that it was connected to Ireland, but I couldn't write the last chapter or finalize the theory without going to see these things in person. And I believe that's an essential part of any research, is if you're going to put out an idea, you have to have been there and seen these things. And, you know, hands-on experimentation and research is the only way to really understand these things. So I did go to Ireland in 2018 and came up with a theory for exactly how these structures were operating. And man, it's been a really amazing journey so far. Again, the name of the book is The Land of Chem. So my Instagram, my YouTube, and the website for buying the book is all The Land of Chem, thelandofchem.com, at The Land of Chem on Instagram. And then my YouTube is also The Land of Chem. And of course, Chem is spelled C-H-E-M, as in the land of chemistry.
Awesome, man. That is fantastic. The work you're doing is awesome. It's a great different way to look at the purposes for these, and I think it's going to be something that a lot more researchers are going to be looking into and considering, because, man, I've never considered this, and I want to look into it more, so it's really awesome.
Dude, I really appreciate that, and I'm going to fired my video up here so we can catch up real quick, man.
Yeah.
Dude, I really, really enjoyed this, and I appreciate you having me on. It's been awesome over the past couple of weeks to see people getting interested in this theory. And again, there's still a lot of work to be done. And I've never claimed to be the penultimate expert on the Egyptian pyramids. And again, there's still a lot of things about these structures that I don't fully understand. And we may never get to really understanding what they are truly capable of. But I think if enough people kind of put their heads together, and you're getting researchers from different avenues looking at these structures. So you need masons, you need engineers, you need physicists, you need chemists, you need all of these different disciplines to go to Egypt and reverse engineer these structures. So that's one of the things about the science of Egyptology. So this science was developed during the very early 1900s. So late 1800s, early 1900s. So these guys were not physicists. They were not chemical engineers. They were at best archaeologists or treasure hunters. And they were looking at these structures prior to our modern industrial revolution. So our civilization hadn't gone through the transition of producing things on an industrial scale yet. So they would have had no ability to conceive of the Egyptian pyramids being large machines, because we as a civilization hadn't made large machines yet. So with that limited understanding in the early 1900s, they go and they see these things and they're like, oh, okay, it's a burial. This is a burial. That's a burial. It's all religious and spiritual, and it's all burials, and there's nothing else to see here. Well, I think it's part of our duty as an advanced civilization now is to go back and reevaluate these structures using the knowledge that we have today to, again, kind of reverse engineer them and to learn more about what they're truly capable of, because there's so much more of a story to be told than just the pharaonic burial story.
100%, man. And excellent work. Thank you so much for coming on. I'm going to leave a link to your YouTube channel in our description. Everybody go check that out. Go check out his book. And thank you so much, man. I'm going to have to definitely have you back on in the future. I know you'll kicking out some new research soon.
Absolutely, dude. I really appreciate the opportunity. Actually, I really, really enjoyed this.
Yeah,
and dude, I'd love to come back anytime. I'm kind of constantly working on new research and new theories. And I intend on going back to Egypt again next year. So anytime you want to have me on, I'm happy to talk about it. And we can dive into more detail about the function of some of the structures. Or if you have any questions, just let me know, man. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, man, for sure. And thank you so much for coming on. Have an excellent evening. And until next time, everyone, have an excellent evening. We'll talk again tomorrow.
Thank you, sir.